This is Emily Wright, tech editor and head of special projects at EG, and it's Friday, which means we're still here. And I'm joined by the lovely Emma Rosser, our residential reporter, who is back a mere week after she was last on this very podcast. Emma, how are you?
I'm good. I was just having a look at all the stories over the week, and I can't believe it's actually only been a week. It feels like so much has happened since we last spoke.
I know, so much has happened. There's been, some sad news, some government news, some continuing generic saga news, all of which you've kind of been at the heart of delivering. So you're absolutely the right person to have back on the podcast. Plus, it's just lovely to chat to you. So before we do a bit of a roundup, how are you? How are things going?
Things are all right. I mean, I've been moaning to you about my flat. I've actually just turned the water off at the mains because my drippy tap is driving me crazy. So there's always something for me to moan about this flat.
Well, at least it's just a dripping tap today, so easily fixable.
Yes, exactly. Well, you would think so, but it has been dripping for a few months now. But I'm not sweltering and hot like last week. That was painful.
It was. I can't believe that was a week ago.
I know. I actually had to check it. It was a week ago.
You seem to have plunged into sort of, mid-October again now. I mean, it's all over the place. But I think we're kind of used to expecting the unexpected at the moment, aren't we? So at least we're well-trained.
Yes, true.
But talking of expecting the unexpected or not expecting the unexpected in this case, let's start off with a really sad story, which is that Tony Pidgley passed away. In fact, around about this time last week, very sudden, 72 years old, and not expected. So let's talk about that, because you're sort of obviously covering all of our resi stuff, and you wrote an obituary, which anyone who hasn't read it yet should absolutely read it. How sad.
It was, what sad news and what a shock, and everyone was so shocked because it was so sudden. He was 72. But he was every day working. He's notorious for these long days, and he was really at the forefront of kind of the biggest developments, not just in size and the actual developments, but working with modular housing and community ownership and driving the industry forward. So really awful news, and so many people have been really affected by this as well. And we have had over the last week contributes just pouring in, emails over the weekend, everybody also sharing their stories on Twitter as well. And then I've been able to speak to some people who knew him well this week to write the obituary. When people talk about Tony Pidgley, they talk about those early starts, that absolute drive and dedication. But one thing that comes out a lot, they talk about his character and his sense of humour. And so this week I've listened to so many people just cackling down the phone, telling me their stories and their lovely memories with Tony Pidgley. So the tribute in the magazine includes some great stories from Jackie Sadek, Nigel Hugel, John Walker, Gerald Ronson, Nick Walkley, David Luntz. And this is residential royalty from all parts of the industry. And he really, affected and knew so many people across all walks of life. And there's so much that we weren't able to include in the tribute, sadly. So actually Jackie Sadek had sent me an email that really captured it from Tony, that really captured his personality and what was important. And so, as I always like reading things out, I'm going to read a little snippet out, if that's all right.
Of course.
This is just a snippet of it. So, it's always about how we make places and create communities and how we get people from all walks of life to live together and share the benefits of that community. So this is just in an email where he's not expecting anybody else, this is directly to Jackie. And then he signs off saying, last but not least, you can see the factory, but you have to sign a confidentiality agreement in blood. And all of his emails, he never wrote them. He would dictate them all to his PA, Joe Potten. And so I think that really captures the values and the sense of humour as well. And when I was talking to Jackie about it, she said it was all the life enhancing stuff, the humour, the generosity, that was what made him special. So just lovely. Oh.
Well, it's lovely to hear such wonderful tributes coming in. So, obviously founder and chairman of Barclay Group. As most people know, had such a different start in life. You know, Bernardo's boy, done good. I mean, done incredibly, you know, incredibly well, and but always maintained such a sense of, you know, what it was all about and what he was all about. And I think that, you know, that that sort of email exchange that you just read out there just epitomizes that. A great loss to the industry. And he the few times I was lucky enough to meet him, I can attest he is or was rather gosh, that's a slip up, isn't it? That's what happens when people pass away suddenly.
Been doing it this week though, like still wrapping your head around it.
He was such a funny man, such a wonderful sense of humor, and the industry's great loss. Very sad news, and anybody that would like to read the obituary really should do, because it's, you know, it's wonderfully put and it's a great tribute. Oh, so sad news, and it feels it feels very strange sort of moving on from that to talk about other stuff that's been happening this week. But I know we must, and you know things do move on and go on, and in Boris's mind, you know, it is go, or rather build. What a week for that as well.
So he's called on the industry to build, and unveiled this new legislation as well, that they'll be looking to introduce in September, and it's all part of Project Speed, he has dubbed it. And a big part of this would be enabling redevelopment of vacant commercial buildings as housing, and those commercial buildings could also be housing. So it's really just redevelopment of anything that's not currently in use as housing. And a lot of this, it might actually come as no surprise, because he's reiterated the pledges from March's budget. But he's pushing it through very quickly. And there are some extreme measures as well. And so the measures being rebuild, no need for a planning application. So it's much faster, but it's hugely controversial. So existing permitted development rights, which is the mechanism for office to resi conversions, have created a surge of homes that have been dubbed slums of the future. The headline is always slums of the future, and they typically have a lot of them, not all, but a lot of them have very small, light is an issue there as well. This is happening because they bypass local authority planners and certain requirements that you would need to get the planning permission, and also the developer contributions, so Section 106 affordable housing and community infrastructure levy. Still, which brings me on to generic.
So on to generic. Oh my goodness!
Do you like that segue?
Brilliant.
So on that note, so that's all going through, and that will go through in September, and there has been a big response to that. But Robert Jenrick's Westbury saga also continues to roll on. And this week, the Housing Select Committee Chair Clive Betts wrote to Jenrick in response to the texts and emails that the government released last week. Can you believe it was only last week? Crazy. It's flying by. So Betts had said, the committee respectfully disagrees with the Prime Minister's assertion that the matter is closed and believes that there are important lessons that must be learned. So he's requested that Robert Jenrick answer 26 questions, including he's asked for an explanation as to why the Housing Secretary initiated contact with Richard Desmond. So in those texts that we're going through, and what motivated him to approve the scheme. So all very saucy. And then Robert Jenrick will need to respond to those questions by Monday. And he's also been asked to give public evidence to the Select Committee on July 13th, which means I will probably have another update next week and the week after.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Well, I wonder what kind of a weekend he's having.
I know.
He's got until Monday.
How is Robert Jenrick spending his weekend?
Oh, my goodness. It's the saga that continues. It really is. Oh, well, thank you very much for the update on that. I think that, you know, people will, you know, Lucy Alderson, our reporter who's been on a couple of these podcasts, joke that the Jenrick saga should be made into a Netflix sort of mini series, although it's, you know, fast extending to become a full blown series at the moment.
It really is. Honestly, wouldn't surprise me. It's actually an idea, to be honest.
Yeah, people might be sort of tuning into this podcast just to hear the next instalment. Wow. Well, thanks very much for the update, Emma. I know that you've been working sort of hard and all hours to make sure that you're kind of up to date and all this stuff, because some of it gets released at, you know, antisocial hours as well.
Funny how they do that, isn't it?
yeah, wonder. But thank you so much for joining me here again today. You know, it's great to have you back, and it's great to get that update. And also lovely to hear some of the wonderful tributes that have come in for Tony Pidgley as well. So what a week of news, a very mixed bag. And speaking of, you know, a week for news and sort of slightly unusual things, we've got an interview now coming up with the architect HOK about some mobile and modular COVID-19 testing labs that they have designed and are developing with a US-based company. So time to tune in to hear about that and how that's going to help fight the help in the COVID-19 effort. And until next week, we're still here, and we'll still be here next week, of course, as well. Thanks very much. This is Emily Wright, Tech Editor and Head of Special Projects at EG, and I'm joined today by Gary Clark, Principal and Science and Technology Leader at HOK's London Studio. Good morning, Gary. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thank you, Emily. Thanks very much for inviting me on.
Not at all. So we are talking today about mobile COVID-19 testing labs, and you are very well placed to discuss this because HOK and Germ Free, and I want to find out a bit more about Germ Free, have partnered to design one of these, or several of these, mobile COVID-19 testing labs. And I want to hear all about it. But before we do, I want to hear how you're getting on, as I always ask on this podcast. How are you faring as lockdown continues? I mean, we're seeing some easing, but it's been a long old slog so far, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing how time passes quite quickly. It's over 3 months already. Really well. Thanks very much. I mean, the transition to remote working went pretty well in HOK, and we're doing generally well. Obviously, there's a few projects that have been put on hold with some uncertainty, but at the same time, which is quite extraordinary, we've actually been bidding and winning work remotely as well. So it's kind of balanced up. So I think we're very kind of positive and hopeful that we're going to have a V-shaped recovery. So that's really as much as we can hope for really just now.
We like to hear that. That's a nice Friday feeling when you hear things like that. So thank you very much. So we're here today to talk about sort of a very timely and yeah, it is exciting, but it feels weird referring to it as exciting because it's, you know, off the back of this very difficult period of time, but, you know, an exciting project designing these mobile COVID-19 testing labs. Tell me about it. How is it going to work? What exactly is it all about? And I know that there are certain sort of places, like, you know, higher education campuses and corporate campuses where these will be deployed.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, thanks very much. I think the first thing to kind of say is, in terms of the context, it is HOK really have kind of been trying to kind of team up and trying to, you know, help organizations with the lockdown and then transition to, you know, a kind of new normal as well. So this is kind of one part of all our work. So you know, beginning with helping the NHS, where we're printing masks for the NHS at the beginning of the lockdown, and our workplace team has been quite active in terms of helping guidance to clients in terms of what that means to a new way of working in offices. And then within the science and tech sector, we're actually looking at advising our clients in terms of return to working in labs. So the HOK Jeffrey is one of those kind of suite of tools and projects that we've kind of teamed up with. So quite exciting. So this was originated with our partner and director in the States called Tim O'Connell. And so he worked with Germfree for many years, and we do lots of modular labs for all the big kind of corporations and government in the States. So it was on the back of that relationship that, again, this idea started. And I think it was also from the higher education sector. And obviously then the context in the States is maybe obviously different to the UK, where I think there's a bit more of where companies are actually doing their own thing in terms of trying to augment and help the kind of national effort. So that's really how the idea kicked off. And the team had been working hard on that with Germfree for, you know, a couple of months. And that's where the design is kind of came from. So in terms of what we're talking about is Germfree is a company that actually make modular labs, and they make a whole range right at the back of in the back of trailers and going right up to articulated lorry type size labs. And then also they do modular labs, which can get helicoptered in anywhere in the world. And I think that also they were involved in the Ebola outbreaks as well. So again, a fantastic kind of sort of resource. So on the back of that, that's where we looked and went into the detail of what we need to do to take testing to where people are, rather than actually where at the current moment throughout, obviously in the UK and US, you've got to travel to a testing facility. And obviously the UK test facility is the airport. So you've got to first own a car and then you've got to then drive yourself there. So it's the opposite. It's really trying to take testing right to where people are. And that's where, you know, in terms of the scalability really kind of comes in. And really the main thing here is we're trying to augment the national effort and really it's a take up from different sectors. So coming into higher education, that's obviously the starting point there in terms of a campus. The higher education sector are obviously they're thinking very hard about how to return in terms of a blended learning approach and so forth. So if you imagine if a higher education facility can have one of these testing facilities on campus, and obviously the students obviously don't have cars or taking public transport, that's where hopefully the uptake of testing would be quite quite increased really. The units themselves, they are kind of two units, and they're all kind of designed as a BSL2 lab. So again, they're all passed in terms of the WHO and obviously the US sort of public health requirements. And I think that Germfree are going through the through that process with Public Health England and Scotland as well. So I think that's the first thing. So you can actually do the testing actually in the actual mobile facility, so it isn't sent off anywhere. And the machines that they've kind of sort of specified, and I think it's a range of machines, and all depends on the type of facility and then who you're partner up with in terms of clients. Each one of these machines can do about 500 tests a day. So if it's a double unit, which is 1,000 tests per day, and it takes 2 to 6 hours to get the results back. So that's a kind of major change, I think, in terms of scalability and the time of mm-hmm. getting results. So really that's kind of the main starting point. But then when you think about this and you widen it out a little bit, and again, this is just an idea. The take up obviously is depending on the organizations themselves, but you think of any corporate or large company where they operate a campus, this would be, I think, a game changer, because then you know, instead of just taking a temperature test, you're actually taking a real world test on the day. And so you can then sort of start to build a picture of, you know, who's at risk and who isn't. So we can see, you know, large companies, we can see in terms of science parks or big business parks as well. Really anywhere where there's kind of large, bodies of people coming together. Again, airports perhaps, but again, the throughput there would be pretty large. But actually, ultimately, then you go to Leicester, you know, you think of a small community. And unfortunately, I think this is maybe where we're coming into the most dangerous time, where there's going to be flare-ups and there's going to be local lockdowns. So you imagine if these things can be transported to areas where you've got that kind of cordoning off, then that changes the kind of the landscape a little bit, and maybe helps to kind of ease that lockdown, that local lockdown, as quickly as possible. Mm. So that gives you the background of the actual facility as well. So yeah, we're kind of, again, it's just an idea and it's a concept, and the it really take up is depending on the appetite of the organizations.
And do you have any sort of facts and figures around it? I mean, first of all, I'd be interested to know how big are these modules or the mobile labs?
Yeah, they sit in the back of it's standard sort of size for roads in the UK as well. So again, they're not bigger. They can go in the back of a lorry, basically, without any sort of special arrangements. So generally, sort of the size of that is we can go up to about 4 meters wide by about 40 meters long. So that's, they're smaller than that anyway. So so I think there's no, yeah, there's no kind of major restrictions in terms of the size. It's a bit like, effectively, a porta cabin, but it's a bit more sophisticated.
It sounds like it's a lot more sophisticated. Yes. Amazing. And we are sort of seeing here it can sort of produce up to 1,120 tests a day, which is amazing. And in terms of the costing behind it and how that all works financially, do you have any more details on that? I'm sure people will be interested to know.
Yes, that's right. So the so Germfree have teamed up with they've got a manufacturing arm in Ireland. So Dublin is the main base, but they've also got offices in the UK as well, and it's Ardmac. The supply chain is all ready to go mid autumn. So the design is all done, and I think they're starting to fabricate now. I think that from terms of that, it's either through any contacts through HOK or direct to Germfree or Ardmac. So again, we can pass kind of details through to you afterwards. The laboratory itself is about $1.3 million dollars, or about £1 million. So obviously it's a big hit in terms of a single off cost, and obviously that doesn't include the equipment inside or the operating staff as well. So if you think about, this isn't for small organizations, this is mm-hmm. this is for groups of organizations or big campus. But when you think of the disruption and the costs to business, I'm sure the business case kind of works out in terms of you've got certainty of people coming back. And then in terms of the spike, sort of a second peak, you've got a bit more certainty in terms of how you can manage it. But the main thing to say here is one thing won't solve the problem, but it's really augmenting the kind of national effort. So, mm-hmm. So it's about £1 million for per the kind of unit. And then they're available from mid-autumn.
And let's talk a bit about the design of it. I mean, this is such a kind of necessary, as I say, sign of the times. And I think there's probably a bit of a sort of a quick response to anything like this, which is very scientific and clinical, to think quite rightly about what it's actually going to achieve. But, in terms of the design, I'm interested in that too. You know, this is quite a new thing. I mean, I know that the idea of like the mobile lab isn't new, but the idea of doing it where it's going to, impact so many people potentially. So tell me a little bit about how it looks and how it's been designed and why.
Yeah. Okay. So the visual. I mean, I think obviously we can send you some visuals on this as well. But it's building on sort of Germfree's modular design approach. So again, these are panelized systems. They're very kind of skilled at this in terms of detailing, and we've worked with them for many years. So it's all about making sure you've got that kind of complete airtightness, sort of buildability. And obviously anchor insulation and panels and things like that, because you've got to get that BSL2 is level, means it's got to be absolutely airtight, really is the main thing. So that's kind of the basic thing. So it's a modular approach, and it's got aluminium panels as well. It's kind of trying to get the strength but the lightweight as well, so obviously steel structure with aluminium insulated panels. And then we've tried to make it sort of a bit more less utilitarian than some of the testing facilities we've seen currently available. And it's all that thing where it's trying to kind of put science on show as well, so you can see what's happening with the testing. It kind of breaks down that kind of sort of the black box, and I think hopefully it gives people kind of a bit more kind of welcoming and a bit more confidence of what's going on. So little simple things. It really is a very simple design. This isn't kind of rocket science, but it's all about sort of exacting standards, really. So the modules can either be one of the panels lifts up to create sort of an awning, so you can have a natural awning where you can stand under and you wait for your turn. Then there's a glass screen where you can see the person that's going to take the sample, and then you're given the sample, and it's through some sort of airlock device. So you actually then do the sample yourself, and then you hand it back to the individual who's behind into the lab, and then they will then pass it on along the pod to the testing people, and all that's done all in view, and so you can see what's going on. And then there's also in terms of that's kind of the testing kind of pod design, but actually it can be converted, and we've got the design for a vaccine approach as well. So it's already geared for hopefully when the vaccine comes. So each of those is like a small room. So you enter into the room, and there's a back of house kind of corridor for the staff to kind of enter in from a safety zone. And then that's where you administer the vaccine in a BSL2 environment as well. So it's all geared up for hopefully the next phase. So we've got obviously testing in terms of if you've got it now. Hopefully the antibody tests will be available soon. And again, that changes the complexion. And then finally, that can be used for vaccines when hopefully they're available. And hopefully that will be at the beginning of next year. But the thing is, we don't know. And as all our kind of medical people were saying, is it takes a lot of time to develop the vaccines, but to make sure they're safe. So I think that's the thing. But I think we're going to be in here for, for a considerable period. It's going to be next year. I think the thing to say is actually the Crick. So Paul Nurse. Again, we're kind of building on that approach where he's really advocated a decentralized approach to kind of testing. And it's amazing that the Crick, and obviously we were architects of the Crick as well, that they've used this where they've actually augmented testing in London. I think they're testing North London, and all the tests are taken back to the Crick. So we're building on that, trying to create this decentralized network, taking testing to where people are.
Well, it sounds, absolutely incredible, really. And there's conversations that we wouldn't really have imagined having a few months ago, and how the world has changed. It sounds absolutely incredible, and it's amazing that you guys have been sort of so on the front foot with working alongside first the NHS and now doing this. A quick question before we go. How have you found it, personally being involved in this? I mean, I know that obviously sort of the science side of things is what you do. So it's not going to be completely alien to you, but it must have been quite an extraordinary project to be working on.
Yeah, I think it's really, this, I mean, science is a bit of a passion as well of myself. And so again, it's a natural extension of what we do in the background. So and I think it's I think what COVID has done is really, it's highlighted all the great work of all our scientists around the world. And it puts them in the spotlight. So again, this work has been done. We do this as a matter of course. This is our everyday job, but it just happens to be that this is the timing is absolutely in the public eye. But I think that it's really just to make the point in terms of we team up with a complete supply chain of the life sciences. Right the way through to equipment manufacturers, and it's that kind of whole picture of trying to kind of see the complete supply chain and how we actually make science easier, how do we make it better, and obviously that's that, in terms of our buildings, really trying to kind of do that. The Crick obviously tries to kind of break down barriers between different disciplines, so that actually the scientists can work more effectively and more collaboratively. But I think the bigger picture here is coming to this is I also head up sustainability in the London studio, and I think the big picture here and the big broader issues is really it's COVID, and we've got another emergency that we can't forget about in terms of climate change. But it's interesting the combination of what COVID is really highlighting, the issues that are really impacting climate change as well. So what's healthy for the planet is also healthy for us. And what it's drawn is really air quality is now one of the major issues I think we've got to address. And traffic pollution itself has been linked to 40,000 deaths per year. So you draw the conclusions there in terms of air quality. The kind of the healthiness of our kind of breathing and lungs really is a major issue, and that's obviously COVID has really highlighted the weakness of that. Then you move inside internal air quality, and really that's where we've got problems. Some of our buildings we've been building are sealed boxes relying on mechanical ventilation, And we've got to kind of think about that. And that really is a climate change issue as well. We've got to think about more less energy intensive buildings. We've got to think about natural ventilation, opening windows, you know, purging all that kind of air. But also the other one is density. And we're working with some UCL scientists on this and really looking at the kind of the issue is what's appropriate density of our workplaces moving forward. Again, the idea of, you know, 6 meters squared per person really, I think, is now not an issue in the short term. But obviously, when we get a vaccine back, is that going to be really the kind of issue we're going to take forward? I'm really encouraged with the lockdown in terms of the reduction of commuting and obviously it's amazing reaction in terms of an 8% reduction of CO2 emissions globally this year. So we've got to think about how our workplaces change, and really I think that's where we can see our offices and workplaces will perhaps be more of that kind of social and training hubs. But actually the flexible working will be here to stay. And I think that kind of balance, I think we can't all work at home all the time. And I think that's the kind of mental health issues is very important. But this kind of balance and flexibility, I think hopefully is going to be the way forward. And at the same time, that hopefully will help in terms of climate change.
Lovely. Thank you so much. An absolute pleasure to talk to you today about all the exciting things that you were working on, albeit off the back of what has been a very difficult time. And thank you so much for finding the time to join me here today.
Thank you very much, Emily.
Thank you.